Good evening. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. And very grateful to be here. I am most honored to be speaking at the convention of my home state. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia. Graduated from Northside High in Atlanta in 1961. Thought there might be some. Anyway, I'd like to thank Lynn and the committee and everyone who was involved in any way in our being here. It's always a privilege to do anything that has to do with this fellowship and program that have changed my life and given me a life, and I'm honored to be a member. And I don't think I'm going to be able to express that tonight, but I'm going to take a real run at it. And it's always really special for me when Linda and I are both asked. Some of you, I think, have heard my bride speak. If you haven't, the voice was telling you about all the sporting events tomorrow morning. At 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, there's an absolutely kill-you, drop-dead Al-Anon speaker. It's my wife, and she is not happy that I'm doing this. But I want you to know she has a spectacular story, and she's funny. And I give you again, a lot of AAs never attend the Al-Anon speaker. If you ever thought about doing just one, here it is. This is the one. I promise you this, she will give you things you'll take home and start using tomorrow night if you come hear her. She's got perspectives that have changed my life and an awful lot of others. As a matter of fact, I'll brag on her Al-Anon program for just a second. Her Al-Anon program is so good that I have a sign on my desk that says, Ask Linda. Because if I want to know what she thinks about something, I got to ask her. She doesn't tell me. And unless I ask her to assist me, she never helps me find a parking place. Wow. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And I would tell you this, too. I was at a men's retreat a couple of weekends ago, and it applies here, too. And she said she was going to lead a women's conference or retreat in Cincinnati. And as I was putting her on the dropped her off at the airport, she said, you be sure and tell those AA men at that conference that I love them very, very, very much. And that's why I have to go to Al-Anon. I'm a member of the backroom group in Nashville, Tennessee. And that's Tennessee. And I want you to know I did not come here to talk about college football. Okay? That's not tonight's subject. Not what we're here for. That was something, wasn't it? I like to open my talks with a quotation from... how many Al-Anons are here, by the way? Can I see your hands? Wow. Thank you for coming. I am honored by your presence. Thank you so much. Thank you. I think that's wonderful support. I like to open my talks with a quotation from your co-founder, Lois, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer. She said, I invite God to the meeting. And that was powerful for me. And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I do believe that. But I can tell you something special happens for me if I stop and honor that presence. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask for another moment of silence here shortly. And I'm going to ask you all, if you would please, to invite your God to join us. And in case you're new, or maybe you're not new and you don't have a God, or you got one you're afraid of, or something that's not working, I want to invite you to borrow mine tonight for this time we're together. I'm serious about that. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Just go ahead and get off on the right foot. And just as an experiment, we'll just see what happens. And so let's all, if you wouldn't mind, let's take a few moments and acknowledge the presence of deity and ask for open hearts. Amen. Thank you. I was invited to tell my story. I found the directions on page 29 in the text. Also on page 50. This is the one from page 50. It says, in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Now, I didn't begin my life that way. I began my life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. Recognize that? It's on page 61. I am so insane that I thought if I could get what I wanted, it would make me happy. How insane is that? I mean, how many times did I get what I wanted? And I wasn't happy. I'm not a very good observer. Who, when you were a child, wanted a bicycle, were sure if you could get a bicycle, it would make you happy, and you got the bicycle? Let me see the hands. Come on, we're doing... Okay, fantastic. Thank you. Are you happy, by the way? Okay. Or you guys wanted her, or your girls wanted him, and you were sure if you could get him, it would make you happy, and you got him. Where are you? Come on.
Are you happy? Okay. So I was convinced, though, if I could just get what I wanted, it was going to make me happy. And I still fall victim to that occasionally in sobriety. And that's when I go really, really crazy. I didn't begin drinking until I was 18 years old. I told you I graduated from Northside High in Atlanta in 1961. I went away to Sewanee, which at that time was a men's college. And I got out with fraternity boys, and they started drinking beer, so I started drinking beer. Now, I needed a drink way before then. I needed a drink just that day, the morning I went to kindergarten the first time. Didn't you? Oh, I could have used a double shot that morning. I got a real good friend from Australia that says he was born two beers short of normal. Got that, right. Anyway, I get out with the fraternity boys. They started drinking beer. I started drinking beer. Didn't like the taste. Didn't like the way it felt going down. But I would have done anything to be one of the boys. And somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second one, the magic happened for me. Alcoholics all know what I'm talking about. I just suddenly got taller. And by the way, I didn't drive here from Nashville to talk to you. I come to talk with you. So we're going to do a show of hands. Who got taller when they drank? Come on, let's see them. Yeah, okay. And better looking. You can leave them up. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My pimples fell right off. I still can't believe they don't use it on the TV ads, you know. Budweiser cures acne. I can just see it. Expert on many subjects. Did you get smart? Come on, did you? Yeah, uh-huh. Fantastic dancer. Did you get a double? Get us some doubles? Yeah, okay. You betcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the big, and they did a lot of other things, but the biggest one that it did for me is it made me feel like I was as good as everybody else. I'd never had that experience before. I don't know how it happened, but when I was a very small boy, I became somehow convinced that there were things wrong with me that weren't wrong with other people, and that these things that were wrong with me could never be repaired in any way, and that I was going to go through my entire life not as good as everyone else, and that nothing I ever did was ever going to measure up. And I would never be as good as you were. And if you ever found out who I really was, you would run me off. Because people who had it all together, like all of you did, wouldn't want a defective guy like me around. That was the only thing I knew for sure. And I'm out with the fraternity boys drinking beer that night. And we went from, I'm afraid they're going to find out who I really am and run me off, to, they're pretty lucky I'm here. Two beers did that, right? And that is an entire psychic change. It's precisely what it is. And Dr. Silkworth says so beautifully in our text that that's what I have to get over alcoholism, and it's because that's what it gave me. I needed an entire psychic change. Alcohol gave me one. So if I'm going to get over alcoholism, I'm going to have an entire psychic change from some other source. And let me sort of fast forward, because he said the next function is at 10 a.m. I have till 9:45 in the morning. Was that what the boy said? Hope you all are real comfy in those seats. And anyway, I'll fast forward through part of this. I zipped through a four-year college and 5 years and two summer schools. Where are you? Thank you. Thank you. Okay. And I graduated, and I was sober a number of years before I finally figured out why I graduated. It was because the administration at that college figured out that I was going to keep coming back. And that's why I graduated. I know that's right. And the United States Air Force was taking what they could get in the middle 1960s, and they could get me. And I went to Valdosta to Air Force pilot training. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We started flying the Cessna 172. We flew that for about 6 weeks. We moved to the T-37, which is a twin-engine jet, side-by-side, fully acrobatic. Fully and acrobatic are in capital letters. And it's got a bubble canopy. Fabulous. We ought to get one of those. They're a great toy. And but it would only go about 400 miles an hour. And we flew that for about 4.5 months. And then we moved to the T-38, which you are all familiar with. You don't know that you are, but you are. Because you saw Top Gun, the movie, right? Okay. They didn't have dogfights with MiGs in the movie, okay? Think about, did the Russians loan them MiGs? Okay, no, I don't think they did either. That airplane that they said was a MiG is actually a T-38. It's the Air Force's advanced jet trainer. And when that airplane came out, it took the climb record away from the F-104.
this airplane has afterburning jet engines that will fly faster than the speed of sound. I have gone on numerous occasions from brake release on the end of the runway to 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. Beginning to feel, they don't have this ride at the fair. Okay. This thing has a roll rate. I've been saying for a long time it had a roll rate of 420 degrees a second. It's 720 degrees a second. It'll go twice around every second if you use maximum deflection. And I'll tell you about that, too. Your eyeballs won't track that if you're sober. I mean, it's a blur. A loop is defined. I'm going to impress you now. A loop is a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane pulling positive Gs. Looks like this. Okay. And at 10,000 feet in this airplane, you enter at 500 knots, which is about 550 miles an hour, and you pull up at 5 Gs. Now, you're pulling 1 G right now. It's the force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That is exactly what that means, right? 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5 Gs, where wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. And we lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside. Total elapsed time on that maneuver is under 25 seconds. Okay? And I tell you all of this about that airplane for two reasons. The first one, of course, is to impress you. Anybody? Okay, a few. And the second one is to tell the story of my alcoholism, because I come down from a day of flying that airplane, and we're released at about 5:30 in the afternoon. We're done until tomorrow morning. And I head for the officers' club to socialize with the other pilots in my squadron. Now, I used to go out and get drunk on purpose a lot. I mean, that's the mission. I'm going out to get drunk tonight. I did that a lot. But I also used to kind of take drunk. Did you ever get drunk by mistake? Anybody ever get drunk by mistake? It just sort of fell on you. I mean, it could have happened to anybody. Yeah, it's kind of like a head cold. You know, I didn't have it, and then I got it. I don't know. Right? Okay. Yeah. And so I'm heading to the club this night, and I do not plan to get drunk. That is not the plan. Let's try this. Would you be willing to do audience participation with me? Can we try that again? Would you be willing to do audience participation? Very good, class. Now, when I point at you, fill in the blanks, you know all of the answers, all right? It's 5:30. I'm going to the club. I am not getting drunk tonight. I'm just going to socialize with the boys. I'm going to have one beer, no more than two, right? I noticed some of you Al-Anons didn't play. I am not at this point offended, but it could happen, so listen up. You know these answers, all right? You Al-Anons know the answers. This is what you heard on the phone. And you believed it again. That's why you're here. The ones that quit believing it and ran screaming from guys like me, they don't have to come to your thing. Okay? All right, all together now. I'm going to have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... Right. Exactly. But what happens to me is that somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second one, I get this phenomenon of craving that Dr. Silkworth says never occurs in the average temperate drinker. God bless them. They shouldn't be allowed to drink. They're no good at it. They'll never get it. They don't have that experience. They don't get drunk by mistake. They don't know anything about that. Okay? But I get this phenomenon of craving by the bottom of the second beer, and I don't get home by 7 o'clock. As a matter of fact, I leave the officers' club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... Lynn, this is one of the largest groups of pilots I've ever spoken to. I drive home drunk. My first wife absolutely tears into me. There's quite a bit of information in that sentence if you listen closely. And then I head into the bathroom for what a friend of mine refers to as his after-drinking chores. Let me explain it to you this way. I thought the two greatest and most creative and important inventions of the 20th century were that... You remember that little half-moon shape of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on? That was invented by one of our boys, you know. His knees were all torn up from that tile on that floor. Where'd I put a carpet in? Some of you know that as the prayer rug.
right? Let's see the hands on that one. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I'm right at home. And the other great invention, I think, was that soft commode seat you could rest your head on. You kind of in between, you know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's make me feel at home. Let's see the hands of the pukers. Come on, where are you? Wow. Okay. That's great. It's going to get worse. Let's see the hands of the nose pukers. Come on, where are you? Come out your nose, Everett. Okay. Now, let me tell you about the nose pukers. Nose pukers always quit forever every time they puke out their nose. Is that right? That's right. Okay. Who quit forever? All right, that's good. Let's try another one. Who quit forever, solemn oath, on the Bible in front of witnesses more than once? Okay, that's good. Who peed in the closet? I never did that. I am so embarrassed for you. You should not be admitting those kinds of things in public. Does your sponsor know that you're doing that? I am so embarrassed for you. I never did that. Although my first wife is still angry about that coffee table that used to be in the living room. I will admit that. I did that gag. I have the privilege of taking meetings into jails on a regular basis, and I did that gag earlier this year. There was about 25 inmates sitting there, and I was doing the raise the hands thing, and I said, okay, who peed in the closet? One guy's hand went up, and I started working him over like that. He says, wait, time out, man. No big deal. Wasn't my closet. It's a perspective thing. Okay, so I'm in there bringing up my toenails, quitting forever, and praying. Now, it's not in the literature as such, but I call this the pre-AA prayer. We'll do it together. I'll do the first line, you do the second. Are you ready? God, get me out of this. Blech. You left that out. It's alcoholic for amen. Right. Okay. I brush my teeth and go to bed. It's got to be 2:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock, somewhere in there. I get up at 6 in that wonderland between drunk and hungover. Alice thought she went through the looking glass, right? Oh, yeah. And I get cleaned up and drive out to the Air Force base, and at about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm in that airplane I was telling you about earlier. Ooh, it's exactly right. And have you been to the air show? Have you seen the air shows? The Thunderbirds flew this plane for 7 years, and we did the things that they did. And in a two-ship formation, just after liftoff, I tucked under the leader's tail. If I could stand up, I can almost touch his afterburners. And we're going to be pulling 5Gs going over the top. And yeah, and I'm dying. I am dying. All right? I call it the 4-6 hangover. The 4-6, you remember the ones where the butcher knife went here, come out the back? Remember that one? And I've got a tremor in my hands. My throat and nasal passages are raw from bringing that stuff up last night. Severe headache. Eyelids are made out of sandpaper. I'm sweating booze out of every pore. I absolutely reek of it. I have thrown the oxygen selector lever to 100%. It will not cure a hangover. I've tried it hundreds of times. I have talked to Sandy and Lyle and a number of our other pilots, and they'll all tell you it will not cure a hangover. We tried it many times, right? And I am dying in this plane. Absolutely dying. And the only thing that keeps me going is the sure and certain knowledge that I'll never feel this way in a plane again. Because last night I quit forever and I meant it with all my heart. Right? Meant it every time I did it. I meant it. And what I've just described for you, by the way, if you didn't recognize it, is willpower. We alcoholics have tremendous willpower to have functioned like that. I'm convinced it's the reason that non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics, is they simply don't have the willpower for it. Well, they don't. I mean, the guy goes out on prom night, right? He drinks a pint and a half of Jack Daniels. He pukes on his date's dress. He wrecks his truck. And he wakes up in the jail. And he says, I'm never doing this again, and he never does. Obvious lack of willpower. You can see that, can't you? I am dying. But by 5:30 that evening, I'm not well yet, but my body's resilient. I was in my very early 20s, and I'm feeling a lot better.
And the one thing I know for sure is I ain't getting drunk tonight. No chance. But I do want to socialize with the other pilots of my squadron, so I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer, no more than... I should be home by 6:30, no later than... But I leave the club at exactly 1 because they... And I drive home drunk and I listen to her and I puke my guts out and God get me out of this. Blech, that's exactly right. Over and over again, boys. Over and over again. I couldn't look all the way into the... I'd sit in that cockpit in the morning dying. And I couldn't look into the past all the way to yesterday. I'd say, wait, isn't this a replay? Didn't you do this like every day last week? I couldn't see it. I was powerless over alcohol, and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. Tough combination, powerless and ignorant. Tough combination. I finished second in my pilot training class. Number 2 man in the class. Very proud of that. Some guys can just really hit a golf ball. Well, I could just drive an airplane. I just could. And I drew an assignment flying a 4-engine jet after that, which is to say I've been drunk on 5 continents and don't have a guess how many islands. I did that for about a year. And then I was sent to Vietnam flying a gunship. I was in the Delta at Ben Tui Air Base. We call it Ben Tui. And flying Spooky was the call sign, Puff the Magic Dragon, if you know anything about it. And I flew that for about 6 months. I was eventually transferred into an intelligence mission, which to this day astounds me. And I was at Phuket Air Base up in the mid-country, drinking tequila one night. Did anybody here ever drink tequila? You probably shouldn't do that. Forgive the advice. I shouldn't, for sure. For me, tequila is traveling juice. I start drinking tequila, I need to be someplace else, and I need to be there right now. Well, I woke up someplace else. Did you ever wake up someplace else? Yeah, I woke up someplace else. And collected my stuff, and I was in my flight suit. I found my boots and my sunglasses, my hat. And about 6 o'clock in the morning, 6:30, I'm walking across this airbase to where I expected to have awakened. And I was, by this time, a captain. I passed somewhere around 20 different individuals, one or two at a time at that time of the morning. I outranked them all. They all saluted. But they had the strangest looks on their faces. And I thought, how can these enlisted guys know that I was an idiot in the officers' club last night already? I don't get it. And I walked into the trailer I lived in. I walked into the bathroom and looked. And I'm missing the lens out of one side of my sunglasses. And I don't know it. It was at about that time that my commanding officer... The colonel who commanded my outfit came to me and he said, Captain Lee, you have such a good rapport with the enlisted men and I'm concerned about several of the sergeants and their drinking. Would you counsel them for me? Yes, sir. I'd certainly be glad to. And I did that. I did that. And a few months later, I was flying a mission classified above top secret. You know, classified, you know, top secret and some stuff. And they get kind of serious about those things. And at 4 o'clock one morning, I was so drunk taxiing my aircraft out that I taxied it right off the taxiway off into the grass. Possibly some of you have had that experience with other types of vehicles. A few? Uh-huh. Yeah. If it had been 4 in the afternoon, instead of, yeah, I'm a mile from the tower and there's nobody else moving. If there had been another plane behind me, they'd have called in. Or if it had been daylight, the tower would have seen that. Or if in the weeds off the end of that taxiway there'd been a rock or a stump or a drainage ditch, somebody else be talking to y'all tonight. And I think I might still be in the military prison at Leavenworth. I'm not trying to impress you. I'm trying to set up one of the most important things I want to talk about tonight. And that's that I have the high honor and privilege of carrying meetings into jails and prisons on a regular basis. Anybody else here doing that? Where are you? You bet. You bet. My home group, this is my group. We're taking more than 50 meetings a month into jails and prisons. My group is doing that. We're also, by the way, staying sober. It's a powerful experience. I've never been arrested, by the way. I didn't think I was qualified to carry meetings in jails because I'd never been arrested. And somebody explained to me that the guys in the jails already know how to get arrested. They need no help with that at all. They got that piece. I heard a great misread. Intentional, I'm sure. Rarely have we seen a person in jail who has thoroughly followed our path, right? That's it. We don't see it. But I really enjoy doing that. And if anybody's suffering from depression, I'd like to recommend, get with somebody who just had their hand up. Take a couple meetings into the jail. It will break a depression really, really fast. And unlike a lot of what's being prescribed for us, it will not have a bad effect on your recovery. Now, forgive the opinion. But I sure have seen some people get out of a depression in a hurry, taking a meeting into a jail. I had an experience a few years ago, sitting in a little restaurant having lunch one day, and this fellow walks up to my table and he says, "You don't remember me, do you?" I said, "If I should, I apologize. I don't know you." And he says, "You came into a prison I was in a couple years ago, and you spoke, and I heard you, and I believed you. I'm doing the things you said. I'm never going to be locked up again in my whole life. I'd like to thank you for my freedom. I'm overpaid for the rest of my life." I want you to have that experience. Powerful. Powerful. We're having a lot of fun with it. I was telling some of the fellows before we started, we're doing weekends in the jail now. We do 3 hours on Friday night, all day Saturday, half a day Sunday. And a team of eight of us from the back room take between 40 and 50 inmates through the 12 steps in that time frame. Our girls have got a one-day format where 10 of them take 30 female inmates through the work from 6:30 one morning, Saturday morning, until 4:30 that afternoon. And they're showing up now. This happened. We do this every couple of months, and we had an experience a few Saturdays ago where a fellow named John from my group had chaired that, and he had a letter from the inmates talking about how now they understood and their lives have been changed, and they'd all signed this letter, and he read it in our meeting on Saturday. And the next guy that spoke, his signature was on that letter, and he was sitting in our meeting, and he's still sober today. And the next day, we had our annual canoe float and water gun battle, which is an annual event at my home group. Now, don't be thinking water gun. You've got to remember who you're dealing with, right? And, yeah, that's right. Let's overdose. And this young man was there in one of the canoes, and he's still sober. Last Sunday in my home group, I counted four people that we found in the jails that are now sober members of my home group. We're on fire. I hope you're involved in that. If you're not, try it once and see what happens. It's an awful lot of fun. But anyway, we're off the end of the runway drunk. Some of you may be wondering how I got out of that. And I'll explain it to you. I flew that mission, by the way. And the reason, you know, how could you fly the drunk? The answer is it's a big sky, you know. Don't take my word. Next time you're out, have a look. It's really big. And if you'll pay close attention, you'll notice there isn't much up there. So the trick, if you ever, and I hope you don't, but if you ever have to fly drunk, if you just keep the airplane up in the sky part, well, everything you hit was on the ground, wasn't it? It's really obvious if you think about it. After 5 years, I resigned my commission and walked away from the greatest job I think I'll ever have. They tell me you're cured of it if you can ever hear a plane go over and not look to see what it is. And that's over 30 years since I've flown. I miss it every day. Alcoholism did not take away my dreams. It took away any chance they had of coming true. I was living my dream when I had to walk away from it. I got a job as a sales rep. I got a business partner. And in the summer of 1984, he realized I was in trouble. And he told me I was going to treatment right now or we were done. And I said, okay. And on June the 28th of 1984, I signed into Ridgeview in Smyrna, Georgia. And I was that, by the way, June 28th is my sobriety date. It's also my belly button birthday. Yeah, and it still is my belly button birthday, by the way. And I mention that because that's the only thing I didn't have to change. I don't know what's happened to you, but that's about all I got left from what I had. And I was a very unhappy man when I got there because I thought the fun was over. I didn't know I hadn't had any fun yet. I thought the book says stupid, boring, and glum, and that's what I thought my life was going to be. And I just, one of the many, many things I was wrong about. There's a wonderful line here on page 42 in the text that I just love. And it says, it meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. I think that says that some of what I know for sure ain't so. And that was one of the things I knew for sure, is that I wasn't going to have any fun. Boy, was I ever wrong about that. Well, I didn't sleep the first 3 nights I was in treatment, and they tell me if you're on the mixture of stuff I was on, that's real common. And so I'm laying there the fourth night knowing I ain't going to sleep again. And as some of you may recall, if you're not drinking and you're not sleeping, it stays dark a really long time at night. And so I'm laying there on this interminable night, and a review of my life happened. I really enjoyed this afternoon's speaker, by the way. I don't know where Lily is, but thank you. Absolutely right. Let them in. But Lil talked about having had a near-death experience. And is that the next speaker? Welcome. Yeah. Okay, that's it. I forgot. I'm going to have to start over with my name. But what happened as I was laying there in this bunk that night is a review of my life, and it wasn't one of those real fast things that the near-death people talk about. It lasted several hours, and I saw my life in miniature little frames at a time, and it wasn't very pretty. I'd always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you've ever run across. I have some spectacular intentions. Let me give you one of my favorites. I'm an amateur magician. I do close-up, and I always intended to get a clown suit. When I was on the road, instead of, you know, hitting the saloons and chasing the women, I was going to put on the clown suit and take my magic kit and go into Children's Hospital and do a show. I think you will all admit tonight that only a truly spectacular individual would do that. I, by the way, have not done it yet. But I intended to do that for a long time. Right? And I was giving myself full credit for it. Because, you know, one of these days, our third step talks about a decision. To me, the difference between an intention and a decision, so an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. It's a huge difference. And this night I'm laying there and I see my life in little pieces. The intentions are gone. It's not a pretty story. And I got to where I thought about the single worst thing I'd ever done. I have one that stands alone. And I'd always been able to stop it. You know, three fast scotches will take that out. Six-pack do it in about 20 minutes. I'm laying there in a bed in a treatment center. I can't even leave the room. And I lay there with that for a period of time, I don't know how long. And I reached what I call bottom. I do not see its definition in my literature. This is my experience. Bottom for me was not physical. I have thrown up blood on more than one occasion. I've been in lots of different kinds of trouble. I know men who are serving long prison sentences who are not at bottom. Bottom was in here. Bottom for me was of the spirit, where I hated my guts at such a level and was so repulsed by the things that I'd done that I would pay any price and do anything not to be that man. That for me was bottom. And from in here, this never happened up here, from in here, screamed to a God I didn't believe in, God, forgive me. And I received the forgiveness in that moment. I'm going to try to describe it to you. I'm laying on my back on the bed with my eyes closed, and then my spirit screamed out that prayer. Everything I'm about to tell you happened in the next instant. Suddenly, there was this magnificent light shining just on me. And with my eyes closed, I can see the entire room in detail better than I can see this one right now, quite frankly. And it felt like something heavy was laying on me. I was unaware of it until it flew off of me at the same instant. And my body felt so light, I thought I might float up off of the bed. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love. And I used to say, "For God forgave me," in that moment. And I don't know that's true. I don't speak for God. But I know that I received the forgiveness in that moment. Maybe he never judged me, I don't know. But I know I received the forgiveness in that moment. I lay there in the presence of this infinite love. It was the most astonishing thing that's ever happened to me. And I do not know how long I lay there. I've talked to other people who've had similar experiences. And what we call time does not exist in that presence. And after that, I must have slept because I woke up the next morning. And when I woke up, I wanted to be one of his guys, and that was my first cornerstone. My second one, and I want to tell you, by the way, that I do not believe for a second that would have kept me sober to the night. I do not believe it. This is Bill talking about his experience on page 12 in the text, because he had something similar. He says, "But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself." That's my story also. I do not believe that would have kept me sober to this day. And I don't believe that asking God every morning and thanking Him every night is going to keep me sober either. In the back of the book, it talks about how that didn't work for somebody. It's on page like 158, 160, somewhere right in there. But anyway, I woke up the next morning. I wanted to be one of his guys, and that was my beginning. My next cornerstone came a couple of weeks later when I went into my counselor's office one afternoon. He was working on my aftercare plan, and I went in to assist him. If you're new and you don't know why that's funny, this one's for you, okay? And I explained to him that I wasn't going to halfway house. I wasn't taking antabuse, and they had a 28-day program. I wasn't staying a minute longer, and I was just doing that to lay out the parameters to help this man do his job, trying to be helpful. And he said, "You've left out something you aren't going to do." And I said, "What?" And he said, "You aren't going to make it." I took that personally. And by the way, before I forget, he was a member of Al-Anon. I salute you again. Man saved my life. He saved my life. He asked this fabulous question. He said, "If you already know how to run a program to keep yourself sober, how is it that you happen to be a patient here?" And I responded by glibly saying, and nothing came out, and I'd never had that experience. I could always answer. Did you always have an answer? I mean, I know you had to make some of them up, but didn't you have an answer? I always had an answer. Couldn't answer the question. Spent the rest of that day, all day. My body was where it was supposed to be. My mind was back in that guy's office. And that night, I got the answer. I was walking back to my cottage, and I'm just literally walking, thinking about this thing, and the answer goes, showed up right here. Same place the prayer had come from. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. I don't know. And if I'm going to be one of the very few that make it, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not a cafeteria lunch for me and I can take what I want and leave the rest. My wager's too high. I've got too many chips in this pot. Way too many chips. I need to win this time. This time. Here's my recovery. Here's what hangs from it. My life. How many times could a drunken pilot have been killed? Not to mention I drove automobiles. My sanity. I have been to the insane asylum. I have been in the little rubber lockup in my underwear. I'm not going to ask for hands on that. I bet I'm not the only one of those. My freedom. I'm supposed to be serving life in prison like most of the rest of you. My relationship with a spectacular woman who you don't want to miss tomorrow morning at 10. Our children. My job, my house, my cars, my peace of mind. Everything in my life that means anything to me is suspended tonight from my recovery. All of it. For if I lose that recovery, all of that hits the floor and shatters. I'm not saying you're there. I'm saying I am. I need to win now. And so I'm hedging this bet. And when I got that reality at that treatment center, that I'm not going to get to run this, what I did was I embraced what I lovingly today call Step 1, Section B. Aha! Okay. So I don't get to run it anymore. Based on my performance, I have fired me as general manager of my own life. A good manager would have fired me decades ago, right? And this morning, formally, I invited God in to be my manager. My life remains unmanageable by me. It's no longer insane. I want you to know I've read this book a couple times. I can't find the page that says, "Congratulations, having now achieved this lofty spiritual level, your life has become manageable. The keys are in it, the tank's full." Somebody yell out the page number. Help me with this. Right. My life remains unmanageable by me. It's no longer insane. I think maybe it promises me sanity on page 57, maybe again on 84 and 85. It's possible. So we promise sanity. And part of my sanity is I don't want to run it anymore. I've seen what happens when I run it. I don't know how much more of that I could stand. And so I surrendered to the staff at that hospital. To sort of fast forward, I zipped through their 28-day program in 6 weeks flat. And, well, they're doing the math. Did you see that? Went back to Nashville where the only guy in the entire city that I knew that was in recovery owned one of the businesses I called on. He had about 10 years, and I didn't want him to know. At my home group, we call that newcomer thinking. I had a terminal case of newcomer thinking. It was going to kill me. And anyway, I set out after this aftercare plan, and I... my favorite watering hole was on 8th Avenue South, and I didn't allow my vehicle to turn on 8th Avenue South until I had a 2-year chip. I'm not kidding. My car was not even on that street. I stayed away from all of my old playmates. I tried to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I only went to 87. I can remember one particular night. I'm literally getting ready to walk out the door to go to the meeting, and my young son decides he's going to learn to dance standing up in a rocking chair. And we went to the emergency room instead of the meeting, and I believe everybody here will agree that's a pretty good reason for missing. And I didn't know you could go to 2 meetings in a day. Because I got newcomer thinking, and it's going to kill me, all right? And I completed this psychobabble 4-step guide they'd given me. I would like to recommend the actual 4-step. It's in this book. Yeah. If you're not familiar with it, it is not only writing. The 4-step is a series of lists, observations and prayers. And you don't have to figure out what the observations are. They're in here. And you don't have to make up the prayers. They're in here. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, please, I'm going to be here all weekend. Let's talk or get with somebody that led that applause and find out what you have missed. Four steps, one of the easiest steps we got. It's kind of long, but it's real easy. And but anyway, I completed this psychobabble, fill in the blanks, multiple choice, true, false, do you still hate your mother, do you look in the toilet before you flush, four step. And which did me, by the way, no good whatsoever. If I'd actually taken a real four step out of this book, I would have gotten tremendous relief. If you're new and the steps look like they're designed to punish you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the many, many things you're wrong about. Because I was wrong about that. That's what they looked like to me. Anyway, I finished. I called down to Bernie. He's a counselor at my treatment center. He hadn't been mine, but I had asked him if he'd hear my fifth step. Because when I had the big white light experience, I knew I was going to have to tell the whole truth. And the reason I asked him if he'd hear my fifth step is you could look at him until he was ripped out of his mind. You know what it looks like when somebody's stoned. I mean, his face is real relaxed. He's got this dumb grin. When he walks, he moves real slow. I figure this junkie, I'm going to take my fifth step with him. A week later, will he know what I said? He won't know if we did it. So he'd be a great choice, right? Newcomer thinking. And so I called the treatment center, and he says, sure, we schedule. I drive from Nashville to Atlanta. I take my fifth step with Bernie, which is where I began to get the relief that the steps will provide. If I'd been working with a sponsor before then, I would have already received tremendous relief. But I was, you know, making it up as I went. And just as an aside, by the way, Bernie was not stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. All right, it was just... Newcomer thinking, ah, yes. I get back to Nashville, and the only thing I haven't done that's on my aftercare list... Okay, this is a two-word fill-in-the-blank. See if you got this one. I was so insane with my newcomer thinking that I was looking for a sponsor I could relate to. Is that not hilarious? Oh, I will be forever grateful that I did not find one. I mean, think about it for a minute. I can't figure out that you can go to two meetings in a day. Who can I relate to? I can relate to the squirrel in the next branch that doesn't know his fanny from a hot rock. That's who I can relate to. Boy, do I ever not need a sponsor I can relate to. We'll die. It'll kill us both. It's true. It's true. And what I needed was a sponsor I would obey. It was a concept I was not familiar with. And... Anyway, I finally spotted this guy in a meeting, and his lights were on. You know what I mean? And I wanted to feel like he looked. And I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, sure, here's your first assignment. Do this and I'll sponsor you. I said to myself, assignment? What? What with assignment? I thought a sponsor was kind of like a big brother who's going to sort of show you the ropes and maybe fix your wife. Well, it's one of the many, many things I was wrong about. And asked me later, I'd be glad to tell you. I just don't have time right now. I did the assignment. I came back. I said, okay, Jerry, I did what you said. I said, sponsor me. He said, sure, my way. I said, what does that mean? He said, you are too sick to stay sober on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And that's what I came to talk about. Yeah. And I didn't know what he was talking about. He said to the very end of his life, he thought that the best kept secret in our fellowship was the definition of our program. Now, how do we keep it secret? Well, we read it at every meeting. That's how we keep it secret. Mm-hmm. It's on page 59 of the text. It's the sentence before the first step where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a... No steps, no program. If you're not doing these steps, let me do you a favor. Don't think you're in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are not. You may be in the fellowship. If you say you are. But you are not in the program. And Jerry said, you're going to have to do these 12 steps. And I was honest with my sponsor. I recommend that highly. I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. He said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, long as you do them. Jerry, we're not communicating. Yeah, we are. That's your definition of willingness. Willingness is what you do when you do what your sponsor says, whether you want to or not. Oh. Well, he finally convinced me I was going to have to do them. And I'm on a soapbox again. I apologize for that. I'm going to do it right now. We are killing people with a phrase, and the phrase is don't drink and go to meetings. We are committing murder with that. That's it. I'm done. I'm medium. About medium rare. How about that? I mean, we're killing people with that because they think it's our program of recovery. If you think so, if sitting with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problem is going to get people sober, wouldn't the guys under the Shelby Street Bridge in Nashville, Tennessee be sober right this second? You bet they would. That's who they are, and that's what they're doing. It ain't working for them, and it don't work for us. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I heard this the other day on a tape. I wish I knew who it was. I'd give him credit. He said, for those of you who are hiding behind the fact that the 12 steps are suggested, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you're right. They're only suggested. The bad news is they're the only suggestions we got. Anyway, I said, Jerry, why do I have to do these 12 steps? And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. I think it's the easiest assignment he ever gave me. I could do that. Know what I mean? Yeah. He said, what we're going to do with these steps is dump you out. We're going to scrub the can, stand it back right. Most of your life's garbage, we're throwing it away. Some of it's good, we'll keep. Two examples. You love your children? I said, I sure do. He said, great, we'll keep that. And then he got wise. He said, when you go to work? You do a pretty good job, don't you? I said, yes. He said, well, we'll keep some of that. When we get through with these steps, you're going to be a big clean can with just a little bit of good stuff in the bottom. Because our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We got to drill before we can fill. We've got to dig this poison out. If we just fill with the good stuff, poison's still in there. It's going to get sicker. It's going to explode. And he said, but like the dentist, we got Novocaine. We call it home group. We call it sponsorship. We call it fellowship. We call it love. Get some. Load up. This is not near as hard as you think it is. It's not hard. And he said, the reason that you need that big empty can with just a little good stuff in the bottom is because one of these days something's just going to slam into your heart. The example he gave you says your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big, clean can empty with just a little good stuff in the bottom, if you don't have that clean, empty space to store that pain in while we love you back to spiritual health, you'll escape. Because that's what you are. You're an escape artist. And alcohol is not your problem. I said, what? Alcohol is not your problem. Alcohol is your answer. It's what makes you tall enough and smart enough and good-looking enough. It's your answer. When we ask you to lay down booze, we haven't said put down your problem. We've said lay down the only answer you've ever known. It's the only thing that ever made your life work, the only thing that ever made your skin fit, the only thing that ever made you a member of the human race. Put that down. And when I do that, I'm without an answer. And I'm the kind of guy that needs an answer. I could quit drinking for periods of time. I could quit forever, which, as you know, is somewhere between 20 minutes and about 6 weeks. Right? Yeah. I could quit for that period of time, but I couldn't want to stay quit. I couldn't render myself unthirsty. I mean, there'd be times, but I needed a drink. What I needed was be transformed into the kind of guy who not only isn't drinking, but isn't thirsty. This is the piece I needed. I needed the not thirsty part. I'd like to quote from the text on page 60, 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result. That's what it says. I appreciate the way Bill read it tonight. I hear it read a result a lot. It's not what it says. The means one. What we promise you is a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. This is my experience. Spiritually awakened people don't drink, and they are not thirsty. If you're new here, I haven't been thirsty since December of 1984. I remember it. You're walking around just not drinking? I'm not. I'm walking around happy, joyous, and free as a result of having had a sponsor who loved me enough to insist that if I wouldn't do these 12 steps the way he laid them out, at the pace that he laid them out, that I could get somebody else because he didn't work with losers. It was that simple. I do not allow the men that I sponsor to work with men who will not do what they ask them to do. It's not fair. We're killing them. My sponsor coached me through dropping a guy when I was sober 5 years. Broke my heart. I couldn't believe it. I didn't think he meant it. And he said, I was talking to him about the same guy. He says, drop him. Tell him you can't sponsor me. I said, come on, I'm serious. He said, I'm serious. He said, what are you asking him to do that he's not doing? And I said, well, call his parole officer, look for a job, go to a meeting every day, start his fourth step, and open and close his days on 86, 87, 88. He said, how much of that's he doing? I said, he's not doing any of it. He said, you are not his sponsor. You are his fire chief. He is his sponsor. And when his tail feathers are ablaze, He calls you and siphons off some of your serenity and puts out his fire and goes right back to doing it his way, and you are not helping him. And then he said, could you stay sober on the program he's working? I said, no. He said, can he? I said, I don't think so. He said, you are probably right. And when he drinks again, you're going to have to sleep knowing that you've told him the truth. And the truth is, he may be in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not in the program. And the reason we have to tell him that truth is because the next time he wakes up in a jail cell in a pool of his own blood and vomit, I want him to have three options. And the three options are continue to live that way, take his own life, or try Alcoholics Anonymous knowing he hasn't tried it because I told him the truth. And if I don't tell him that truth, I've signed his death warrant. And I always take him back. And by the way, if you're having trouble with what I've just said, I'd like to recommend pages 95 and 96 in the text before we talk, okay? Because that's what it says there. And I have found it to be very effective. And a lot of them do come back. I got one guy, I've lost count of how many times I've taken him back. And I'm taking him next time. He's going to come up to me. He's due. He's going to come up to me. And he's going to say, now I really mean it this time. And I know you agreed to sponsor me four other times or six or whatever the number is. And I didn't do it, but I'm hurting unit, and I'm serious. I'm really going to do it this time. I'm going to say, great. I want you to read these four pages in the text today. I want you to look up at least two words in the dictionary on every page. I want you to call me at 8:15 tonight. Let's talk about what you looked up. And the first time he calls me at 8:15 that night, we're going to rock and roll. I'm not throwing somebody's chance away. I'm keeping them from thinking that they got this thing when they don't. And I think it's life or death. Anyway, this man coached me through the 12 steps, and I have had a spiritual awakening as the result. And it is that spiritual awakening and continuing to keep it current, like it talks about in the text, that I think is the reason I stand before you at peace. I'm okay with me tonight. I hope you like me. I'm okay if you don't. That's huge for me, because I didn't have that when I got here. I didn't have anything like that when I got here. I'm going to tell you an awful story. This is a terrible story. Brace yourself. Let me tell you that it has a happy ending, okay? This thing has a very happy ending. On July the 4th, 1993, my precious daughter fired a pistol into her mouth. And I found her about 6 hours later. And we rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital. And within 20 or 30 minutes, there were 30 or 40 of you having a prayer meeting out front. And by dark, it looked just like this. And they told us for the first 4 days that this little girl's going to die and we can't save her. I want you to know something. 4 days is a long time. She's conscious, by the way, by now. They got tubes stuck in her. She's a nightmare to look at. And she can't talk, but she can squeeze your hand once for yes and twice for no, and she don't want to die anymore. Then they tell us they can't save her. 4 days is a long time. I believe if I had not allowed the man to coach me through these 12 steps, I couldn't have done it. I could not have done it. I needed to be in the program. I needed that empty can to store that pain in. I had to have it. Let me tell you what you did. Let me tell you who you are. I didn't leave that hospital for 60 days. And you didn't either. There was not a time in the next 60 days that there wasn't a member of my home group at least as close to me as Lynn is right now. You guys were out in the hall. You were in the room. You never left me. And if you're new, I want you to know it wasn't to keep me from drinking. They didn't even talk about it. It was so that one of my people would be there if I needed to cry at 4 o'clock in the morning. One of my people would be there to hold me while I cried. I had learned to cry since I got sober. There was a guy in my home group. I'm sober about a year, and I'm watching this guy cry in almost every meeting. And I finally went to him. I said, Tony, tell me about the tears. And he said, somebody says something beautiful and touches my heart, and I just weep, and it feels so good. And I said, Tony, I can't cry. And he said, I will teach you. And he did. And I had learned to cry. That's part of who I am. I got here not knowing anything about myself except that I'm not as good as everybody else, and I'm broken and defective. I have had to learn about me. I'm a very masculine man who cries. If, by the way, you'd like to learn to cry, if you'll see me later, I'll teach you. And by the way, about 40% of the people I have the privilege of teaching are women. That amazed me. I started doing this about 6 or 7 years ago. I've got a handout on it. I'm really serious. I've got a folder full of them right over here. I want to help you learn to cry if you feel the need to do that. But anyway, you people were absolutely spectacular. A friend of mine says you can pretend to care. You cannot pretend to show up. You showed up. You showed up. So I know who you are. Saw what you did. I like your words, but I'm a word merchant myself. Right? I saw what you did. That's how I know who you are. I'm honored to be a member of this fellowship. I sponsor a man. I have the permission to tell this story. I sponsor a man whose son did not live. And I had the privilege of doing some all-nighters at his house and holding him while he cried. And he didn't drink again. I gave him a 17-year chip back in January. But emotionally, he was gone for a long time. You get up close to him and scream in his face, he couldn't hear you. He had that 1,000-yard stare. He just wasn't there. He's there now. And he said it this way. He said, one of these days, you're going to have to go to the mountain all by yourself. If you have not done the work out of this book and you don't know how to reach up and take God's hand, you're not going to be able to go. And I believe it. Here's a promise. Well, we read the promises. I don't mean to be maudlin. Here's the promise from page 14 in the text. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive. I believe that's a death threat. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. We wish you trials and low spots. I hope you got an empty can with just some good stuff in the bottom by the time you get to them, because I think they're coming for everybody. Miss Linda and I spent last night with that daughter I was just telling you about and her husband, and had a fabulous time. She sends you love. She's doing great. She's blind in one eye and has lost just a little bit of coordination, and she's just doing fantastic. And she sends you love. It's just... And I started going to the old Woodbine Club in Nashville. It's no longer there. And they had these slogans on the wall. And one of them said, let go and let God. I thought, that's a great idea. I wonder how they do that. And then one of them said, first things first. I understood that. But I was a newcomer, of course. I wasn't doing it. And another one said, one day at a time. I know what that means. Don't drink today. And boy, if you're new, it does mean that. But eventually, there's more to it than that. This is my experience with it. The first 10 steps have cleaned up my past. I got nothing. I'm not having to look over my shoulder. Nothing's gaining on me. Steps 11 and 12 are about me getting excited about the idea that loving God holds my future. I've got a friend that says he spends too much time in his head trying to clear away the wreckage of his future. Like that? Don't borrow pain from the future, right? First 10 steps, my past is clean. 11 and 12, loving God holds the future. Those two facts combine to free me to live one day at a time in this day. If I don't have both of those in place, I can't be here. That's in part what the steps are about. But they had one slogan on the wall. It was the only one I was doing. Made me absolutely crazy to even look at it. You know which one it was? Think. Yeah, boy. Yeah, am I ever doing that? No, yeah. Boy, it's fast in here. It's going really, really fast. And I don't find it in my literature, so I take it upon myself to decide what that means. Use this if you can. Think. That means three thinks is the limit. Whatever it is, I can think about it once. I can think about it twice. That's good, too. I can think about it the third time. When I have thought about it the third time, I must lay it down. For if I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step one, section B. I'm trying to manage it. As a matter of fact, anything that upsets me, all the problems I have in my life today are problems with step one, section B. Because I'm trying, if I'm upset about it, I'm trying to manage it. From the way you drive your car, to international politics, to the fact that this fabulous Al-Anon speaker for tomorrow morning puts the toilet paper on the roll backwards. It should feed over the top, as you well know. Should feed over the top. I fixed the one in the men's room. She says she puts it on the other way because we have a cat. I'm telling you something, been watching that cat for 9 years and he don't use it. He had the sober version tomorrow morning at 10. Anyway, I talk a little bit about some of my experience. By the way, if somebody disagrees with something I have to say, I'd like to hear from you, which would be different from talk to you. I may have a chance to learn something, so please come disagree with me. That's how I learn. So I'm looking forward to that if somebody has one. I walked out of a meeting one time, and a fellow whose sponsor I sponsor disagreed. And what I had said in the meeting was that my amends to my children would never be complete. And he said, that's not right. Did you go to them and tell them what you thought you'd done wrong? Did you ask how you could repair that damage? Did you do that to the best of your ability? Did you ask for their forgiveness, and did they give it? I said yes to all of that. He said, you're trying to be the best dad you can be today isn't 9-step work, it's 12. That's the principles in all your affairs. And if you think it's 9-step work, you have not accepted their forgiveness or God's or your own, and you have work to do. My text doesn't say anything at all about living amends. If you're making them, it's okay with me. I got free that day. I sure am watching a lot of adult children, sick ones, manipulate us because we weren't good parents in the past. My 9-step's complete with my children. I'm trying to be a really good dad today. It's not because I'm guilty. It's because spiritually awakened people try to be good parents. I shared that with you because I got free. And I'm going to share this next one with you for the same reason. I want to read to you from page 124 in the text. We thank each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places, showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes our life seem so worthwhile to us now. I'm about to do that. I'm going to talk to you about the worst thing I've ever done. I want to tell you first that if you have done this and you're good with it, I'm good with it. I'm not here to indict you. This is my story. I'm telling it because probably there are people here who need to get free on this, and I got free. As a young man, I paid for an abortion, and that festered my soul. And I used to think about the what-ifs on that, and I had to drink over it. And that's what I was thinking about that night in that hospital when my soul screamed for forgiveness and received it. But when I got to the 9-step, it looked to me like I owed amends to an unborn child, and I did not believe that could be done. And I have been in the hands of people who were into this book since my early days, and they knew what it said here on page 83. It says, some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And I was sat down, and I was shown how to write that letter by someone who had the experience of writing a letter. And as the 4th step is not about writing, although there's writing involved, the 4th step's about observations and prayers that will change your life. In my experience, this letter is not about writing. It is about tears. And I've seen people who couldn't cry try to get free this way and be unable. And I would like to talk in detail if anybody has, if you have an unborn child, a grandparent, if you have any reason to make amends to somebody on the other side, I'd be thrilled to share my experience with you. I wrote up what I've been given, and I got completely free. Nothing happened in here when I told you about that. It's the worst thing I ever did, as far as I'm concerned. I got free. If you need to get free on something like that, please let's talk later. That's what I come here to do. I want to tell a story about anonymity. I give my last name in AA meetings in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. And if that doesn't make any sense to you, I'd like to recommend the pamphlet, Understanding Anonymity, and the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. That's my understanding of what we're supposed to do. I noticed the speaker this afternoon spelled her last name, said she was in the book. There's a bunch of Scott Lees in the Nashville book, but call the central office. They know which one I am. But anyway, anonymity is not about hiding from each other. We're not a secret society. Anonymity has to do with press, radio, and films. But it also has to do with doing something good and not getting caught. I want to tell an experience that I had a number of years ago. I did something good for somebody who didn't get caught. Nobody knew. And this is going to sound poetic, and it really is, I suppose. But it was like there's a golf ball-sized piece of sunshine lodged itself in my chest. And I could think about what I've done any time of the day or night in any situation, and this thing would glow and send my light through my whole body. And I didn't tell anybody for about 6 months. And when I told, that thing got out. Right? And I'm told when I do something good and I don't get caught, God gets the credit, and I get one of these. And what I did, because I can tell you now, I took a little boy fishing that wasn't going to go any other way. It's kind of a long story, but he was about 8 years old, and I put him in the front of a canoe, and we floated the river. I mean, he caught a 4-pound smallmouth bass that day. He got my fish, is what I'm telling you. And about a mile from the takeout, there's no place to get out of this river, and suddenly the sky has blackened. We've been 7 hours on the water. Suddenly the sky blackens, and the bottom's about to fall out of this thing, and there's thunder, and there's lightning, and the only thing I can do is what they call eddy out. We came down a fast chute, and there was a little backwater, and I sort of parallel parked this canoe up under these these limbs, and I'm about to give God a little piece of my mind. Have you not noticed St. Scott down here with a little boy, and he caught my fish, and I'm just about to give God a firm prayer, and this magnificent little boy looks over his shoulder at me, and he says, "Is it okay to fish here?" I forget that. That's what I'm supposed to be asking when things aren't going my way. Is it okay to fish here? When I was new, I used to say stupid things like, "I'm having a good day" or "I'm having a bad day." Isn't that silly? How would I know? If you'd asked me my first day sober, "What kind of day are you having?" Yeah. And today I can't say that's a bad day. When I say I'm having a good day, what I'm really saying is, my will is being done today. And when I say I'm having a bad day, what I'm really saying is, my will is not being done today. And my will is one of the biggest problems I got, or there's mistakes in this book. It's one or the other. I was sober about 8 months, and I was sitting in the Woodbine Club complaining about something one day, and a guy named Thurman, who had a couple of years, looked over at me, and he said, "Did you ask for God's will in your life today?" And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Well, how do you like it?" I still thank him for that. That was a metamorphosis for me. Something we changed, myself and the men I sponsor no longer give our numbers to new guys. And what we do is we exchange numbers with new guys, because they're not going to call us. Right? When I was sober 100 days, I had 100 numbers. You know exactly how many I'd call, right? Same number you had, right? So what we do is we exchange, and we take responsibility for calling them a couple of times in the next few days. It's nothing for me with a 19-year chip in my pocket to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Fred, we swapped numbers yesterday at the back room. I talk to 5 guys every day that are in recovery. You're on today's list. How's it going?" I'm going to the fellowship group tonight, 7:30 at the Presbyterian Church on Nolensville Road. Maybe meet you there. We'll have a cup of coffee. Nothing for me to do that for him. He can't call me. And it's life or death. And guys with my disease are dying because we're not reaching the hand of AA out quite far enough. I think we ask for too many surrenders. Take that in your heart. See what happens for you. That's something we've been doing. And some newcomers are telling us it matters to them. When I was sober 6 years, I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in. And it was under pretty rough circumstances. And I didn't know what to do. I knew that if I continued to live with her, I was going to beat her up. I knew that. And I also didn't believe in divorce. And I didn't know what to do. And I was given a gift. And I share this with you if you can use it. Well, the gift I got was 3 prayers. And I prayed them each morning. And the first one was, "God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together." And the second one, "If it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart." Those are the easy ones. Here's the big one. "God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing." That's the one. Step one, section B in prayer form. God's guidance will be here right on time. The question is, will I be open to it? If it's his will for me not to know today, I'm asking not to know. I don't need to know. I'm not in management anymore. It's not my job to know. We eventually got divorced, and Miss Linda and I have had such a spectacular... we've been married kind of upon 9 years and are just having a fabulous time. I had an experience a few years ago. On Christmas Day, we ran out of milk, and I ran down to a convenience store, and I walked in and grabbed this gallon of milk, and I got a gift. And the gift was, as I got ready to leave the store and about to pay this guy, I saw him. He wasn't just a way for me to get a gallon of milk and run home, see the ball game. There's a human being standing there at a minimum wage job on Christmas Day. And I got a gift. And the gift was, my heart saw him. And my heart said out loud to him, "Thank you for coming to work on Christmas Day. I bet there's some place you'd rather be. But you see, my family ran out of milk. And if you hadn't come to work today, we couldn't have it. I'd like to thank you for working on Christmas Day." And he and I both cried. I don't know that I've ever thanked anybody enough. Ms. Linda will address that a little bit tomorrow. But I try to be really careful to thank as many people as I can, especially if I do something on the weekend. You know, "Thanks for coming to work today." They get my Big Mac and fries and say, "Thanks, appreciate it. Hey, in the kitchen, thanks for making my lunch. I appreciate you. Thanks." I don't know what happens to them. Can you hear what happens to me? I get the gift when I go out of the way to maybe do something nice for somebody else. It's such a spectacular thing. When I was... I lived in a little apartment by myself for about 3 years. And And one day at a time, I was okay not knowing. I really was. One day at a time. And then one day I knew. But I carry a picture of myself in my wallet taken when I was about 4 years old. And a beautiful little boy. If you'd like to see it later, by the way, if you'll ask me, I'll do you a favor. But sometime after that picture was taken, I started being abused, and I was abused for a long time after that. And listen to this very closely. Nothing happened here while I just told you that. Nothing happened in here. And I never think about it unless I'm telling this story in the hopes of helping somebody else get free. Because, you see, I've been through the forgiveness process in the fourth step. And if all you did was write a four step, I bet you don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Please, let's talk later if you don't have that clue. But anyway, I had this thing blown up, 2 feet wide, 3 feet high. It's on the wall at the foot of the bed. And I'm laying, looking at that thing, that beautiful little boy one day. And I thought, I wonder who he would have become if all that garbage hadn't happened to me and that I hadn't done. Who would he have become? And I got my answer. And the answer was, it is my assignment to become the man that he would have become. If. That's my assignment. I serve a powerful God. Gave me a powerful program. More powerful than all the things that were done to me. More powerful than all the things that I have done. God forgives me for everything I ever did, and he loved me while I was doing it. That's a quote from my beloved back room. I don't have the power to make a mistake so bad that God can't turn it into something magnificent. I didn't say fix. Magnificent. Probably in a crowd this size, God has this evening used the worst thing I've ever done as a tool to help about 30 people. It's a pretty good estimate on tonight. About 30. Powerful God, powerful program. The little boy on the wall, who would he have become? It's my job to become that man. That's my assignment. I accept it. The directions for me are in this book. I'm sure they're available in other places. These are the ones that are working for me. And this is who I am. I'm a guy that cries. And I'm so comfortable with it. So comfortable. Because I'm just me now. You know, my act ain't going to get sober. The acts don't get sober, and the victims don't get sober. Right? I had to quit doing the act. I had to quit being the victim. Take my own responsibility. Freedom is when I accept full responsibility for the results of all of my own actions. I'm kind of like the poodle that wets on the rug. They always told me we learn from our mistakes. Well, I never did. Not me. I learned from living with the results of my mistakes. Right? You've got an untreated alanonic to take away my results. I don't learn anything. Right? I'm like the poodle. When does he learn? You rub his nose in, it's when he learns. That's when I learn. Steps 4, 5, 8, 9, and 10 are about me learning, embracing those results so I can be free. That's what makes me free. My last flight in a high-performance aircraft, I leveled at 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes, and I broke a few rules. I broke a lot of rules. I wondered how high this thing would go. Not supposed to be above 45 in this airplane for two good reasons. One is you could die, and the other is you could get killed very quickly. And I'll give you details later if you want them. And I pulled the nose up and put a little bank. I did an instrument climb, right? I'm not looking outside. I'm doing this climb, and I thought I was going to get to 10 miles. At 52,300 feet, well over a mile above how high I'm supposed to be in this thing. That's back before the radar told them, you know. They had to take my word for it, and I'm sure they were making other mistakes. And at 52,300 feet, this thing ain't going up anymore. We're done. I'm doing 9/10 of the speed of sound, somewhere around 700 miles an hour. And she ain't going up anymore. I hadn't looked outside. I had just come around to a northerly heading, and I leveled it out, and I looked. I was 80 miles west of Jacksonville. I was in the Valdosta neighborhood, somewhere over the swamp down there. And 9:30 in the morning on a clear day. You hear me? Clear day. The sun's coming up over my right shoulder. The sky above me is as black as this ceiling at 9:30 in the morning on a clear day at 52,300 feet. I looked out to the west and saw the curvature of the earth. Really saw it. In 1967, there were not a lot of people who had seen it, and I was one of them. This magnificent blue ball floating in space, and this peace washed over me that lasted for a couple of weeks after that. I only sat there 20 or 30 seconds looking at this magnificent thing, and eased them back and brought it down and landed, and I couldn't tell anybody, because if they believed me, I was going to prison. I mean, it was... I was the town drunk. I was not the village idiot. I'm not. Burke Harlan from High Point, North Carolina, was one of my mentors. Get one of Burke's tapes. Don't go to bed without getting it. But I spoke at his 12th AA birthday, and I heard myself telling that story, and I literally said, I can't wait to find out why I'm telling this. I got to the end and found out. It was my first spiritual experience. And I kept it secret that long. And for over 30 years, I'd wanted to see the curvature of the earth again. It's an unbelievable experience. On June the 29th of this year, Miss Linda and I chartered a Learjet and took two of our kids and went to 51,000 feet. That's right. That's right. I serve a big God. I have learned to dream big. I hope you're serving a big God, and I hope you're dreaming big. Miss Linda says there's no upper limit as to how happy God wants me to be. I believe that. I want to thank that God. I stand before you in stocking feet. I step out of my shoes when this many people invite God into the room. I think I could be standing on holy ground. And I've tried to carry that in my heart up here tonight. It's been good for me. And I asked Him for an open heart, and I got one. And I hope you did. And if you borrowed my God, you get touched. Borrow Him again. Borrow Him again. I was in Knoxville a few years ago at a meeting, and come around the room, there's this old guy sitting there with a scowl, and his arms are folded like this, and I thought, oh, an attitude case, I can't wait. They got to him, and he said, I just come back from an ancient ritual, from a medieval ceremony where 10,000 people sat in an unair-conditioned auditorium wearing long robes. I figured it out. That's graduation, University of Tennessee. I got it. It's commencement. I got it. Figured it out all by myself. And he said Alex Haley, who was the author of Roots, you may recall, was the featured speaker. Mr. Haley was not talking about AA, but this guy said that Mr. Haley's first few words reminded him so powerfully of our program and our fellowship and what we do for each other that he forgot about the air conditioning and the robes. And I'd like to quote Alex Haley, because for me it describes us so beautifully. And what he said was, if you ever see a turtle sitting up on top of a fence post, you'll know he's had help. God bless you, and thank you for the help.